Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
Saka Dawa podcast bonus was originally recorded June 2019 at the home of Robert and Nena Thurman.
Greetings, everyone. I'm very happy to speak to you all today as we are on the cusp of Saka Dawa in Tibetan, or Vaishakha, or Vesak, as people call it, which is the full moon of the fourth lunar month. And this year, the full moon of the fourth lunar month comes actually on the fifth lunar month, because we're in a, I don't know what you call it, in the lunar calendar, every 3 or 4 years, there is an extra month. And in this year, it was the second first month. And that's because the lunar calendar is a few days shorter than the solar calendar. And therefore, that adds up over a couple of years. And then there's another extra month, and they have to get rid of that to get back into sync. But anyway, this is Tibetans on Monday, the 17th of June, celebrate the Saka Dawa, they call it. That is the Vesak month there in Tibetan. When Buddha both was born, in their view, which again is different from other traditions, when he attained his highest enlightenment, and when he attained his parinirvana. All three of those events occurred on this full moon, when the moon was full in the astrological sign of Vesak, Vaishakha. And it's really, many Tibetan Buddhists will be vegetarian for 2 weeks leading up to that during the waxing moon, and or try to be more vegetarian. And try not to drink too much, and try to be like, say some prayers, do their sadhanas, whatever it may be. It's sort of a special time. And the full moon is really quite a marvelous feeling, and particularly when it coincides with all of the world's Buddhas, which are said to be something like 500 or 600 million usually. But I think it's really artificial, because the major number of Buddhists in China who can't openly be Buddhist is huge. You know, in a way, China, except for the Muslims and the Christians, which could not ever have numbered in China more than 150 million between them, although probably they will grow more in a future date when Communist Party has decided it wants to tolerate all religions and go back to the ancient imperial Chinese way of doing that, which I hope will be sooner rather than later. Then they will probably increase. But still, the majority of the Chinese traditionally are Confucian in the office, Taoist in retirement and for weddings and birth ceremonies, and Buddhist for funerals and for meditation and for, sort of transcendent matters, you know, anti-weddings, you might say, monastic matters. And so Buddhism, really almost all the Chinese were in some sense part Buddhism, part Buddhist. And a lot of the art of China is Buddhist inspiration of different kinds. You know, there are different schools, you know, Tian Tai, Lotus Sutra School, Huayan, Avatamsaka Sutra School, Zen, which really is the sutra-less school, but the sutra-less sutra is Prajnaparamita Sutra. And Pure Land, the Amitofo, Western paradise of Sukhavati, the wish to be reborn in the Pure Land. So those are kind of the four main schools, and there were other divisions as well. And so when all of those are combined to celebrate at least the Enlightenment Day, which there's no disagreement about, and I believe also Parinirvana Day, they all agree that that was also the same day, then it's a marvelous world vibe remembering Shakyamuni. When Shakyamuni did attain enlightenment, he touched the earth just before he did. And the reason he touched the earth and the statues you see of Shakyamuni holding one hand in meditative posture, so often with a begging bowl, you know, on the left palm that is in meditative posture, and one touching the earth. And when he does that, he is witnessing, calling the earth to witness all his millions of previous lives, where he gradually became a human and then a bodhisattva, and then he gave his life for others. He devoted himself, as a bodhisattva does, compassionately and altruistically and artistically for others' sake, to make them happy and free of suffering, and finally became a Buddha by doing that. And he touched the earth to show to call the earth to witness, because he was in dialogue with the devil, Mara, the heavenly devil. There are four kinds of devils, but all of them attacked him to try to prevent him from attaining enlightenment, because his one person attaining enlightenment on a planet affects everyone on the planet and helps turn people's attention toward their own individual fulfillment in the higher state of happiness and compassionateness and effective artistry of making a beautiful life for themselves and others. When one person attains enlightenment, it reverberates through morphic resonance throughout the planet, and everyone makes one incremental step in that direction. Everyone, in a way, doesn't necessarily automatically aware. In a way, because the one who becomes enlightened becomes aware that all of them already are present in the field of enlightenment, even though they don't know that, and therefore they don't enjoy it as they could. And because of that awareness, which sort of merges with them in a certain way, their subliminal feeling of being close to a positive possibility is intensified within them. And the ones who are more self-centered and more frightened of connection and more walled off from the vibes of other beings, they are more negative and they're unhappier, so they're nastier to others, and therefore they feel that much less. But those who are more friendly and loving and open and so forth, and are acknowledging of their connectedness with things to whatever degree they are, then they feel that vibe more, and then it has a more powerful effect on them. So that happened, you know, around, well, the Tibetans say more like almost 3,000 years ago, like 2,800 years ago. The Sri Lankans say 2550, something like that. And I think the Westerners more or less adopt a Sri Lankan one. But it's not really clear exactly when the Buddha did live, actually. What some Westerners try to always push it later and later, because they recognize how very similar Buddhism and Christianity are, and they're a little upset by Buddha's priority in the sort of wisdom and love and compassion line over Jesus, you know. Not that there's really any difference between them as great leaders and teachers, but there was a big difference in their social setting. You know, Buddha was not crucified. There might have been those who would like to crucify him. He actually had a half-brother who kept trying to do him in some way or another, who had been competing with him as a layman for the crown princehood and failed. And then when Buddha became an ascetic, a monk, and a great teacher, he tried to rival him in that place, and he himself became a magician and a powerful, because he was a very powerful person. Devadatta is his name. And so that story is like that. Anyway, we're celebrating Vesak today in the full moon. And so we should remember, so he, you know, his last child, he was attacked by Mara, the devil. And then he was through, and who tried to seduce him with lust by sending his girls from the heavenly plane, goddesses, and then sending fierce armies and horrible ogres and trolls and giants, really awful, like something out of Lord of the Rings, like the troll army, you know, the evil one, you know, the nameless one. And all of this failed. And then the last thing that the devil did was, well, he tried to challenge Buddha's self-confidence in a way. And he said, who asked you to be Buddha? How dare you say you're going to save everybody by teaching them, or you're going to teach everybody, you're going to free, open the door to freedom for human beings on this planet. Who asked you? Blah, blah, blah. And so Buddha then retorted to him, well, you became the head devil by doing one good thing when you were in a hell once, but being compassionate slightly to a fellow devil there. And from that single altruistic thought in your mind, you didn't really do anything, but you just had a thought. And from that, gradually snowballed until you became king of the devils, you know, who usually never have an altruistic thought. And that's why they're unhappy, and that's why they're devils. Buddha said to Mara, and so Mara said, okay, your own clairvoyance of former life is such that you are my witness. And then what's your story? And then Buddha said, well, I was altruistic in such a huge way, giving life, body, wives, country, children, kingdom, wealth, eyeballs, bloodstream, whatever it was, I gave to beings again and again over infinite numbers of lifetimes. And so now I can have the infinite attainment of Buddhahood to really fulfill my gift to beings of their own, of helping them find their own freedom. And, said Mara, well, who could possibly be a witness of you doing that? You know, you're my witness because you have clairvoyance of past lives, but who could be your witness of so many deeds that you're claiming? And so Buddha said, well, Mother Earth is my witness because I did this on this planet Earth, Buddha said, sort of catering to the basic Buddhist level of Indian culture that this is sort of the only planet like our modern one, which is not the Mahayana level. Mahayana is much more sci-fi. They're completely aware of millions of other planets, actually, all the time. Beings come from them and go to them in Mahayana vision. You know? But in this story, it's just this planet. So he touches Mother Earth, and Mother Earth jumps up and begins to recite his former life stories, who said she's aware of all of them, and she's the witness for all of them. And then the devil goes, oh, drat, you know, and he finally gives up and goes back to his devil heaven. And that devil doesn't really live in the underworld. He's not a sort of horny, weird character, all scaly and horny, a Lucifer type of image that we have in the West in the Disney films or whatever of a hell-bound devil. He lives in a heaven, actually, and he uses lust to ensnare people. And he has a lot of beautiful slave girls and things, horrible guy, you know, pimp kind of. Anyway, so then Buddha meditates, and then in meditating, he rehearses all that memory of previous lives, and he adds to that during his night of meditation, last night of meditation after defeating Mara, he adds to that remembering other beings' previous lives, and therefore remembering his incomplete entwinement and entanglement over infinite past time with them all. And then he finally, in the early pre-dawn twilight, seeing the morning star, supposedly, I think everyone agrees it's in that pre-dawn twilight time, he suddenly achieves his complete Buddhahood. And a kind of breakthrough thing, although gradually built up to over millions of lifetimes, really, as he puts it. And then there are esoteric versions of the story that are also good. But then upon attaining that and realizing his oneness with the universe as it is in the present and also as it was in the past and also as it will be in the future, which is the only reason why he sort of becomes a Buddha, that is, becomes perfectly free of suffering, attains nirvana, freedom from contamination, as they put it, the third wisdom of that night, is that he sees the other beings' freedom in their future, knowing that they feel they're in a present locked away from their future. But to him, their future is as real and as present as their present is. And yet he also knows that they think of their difference, and he engages with that difference. So it's quite complex, his realization. It isn't just blah, something where everything all disappears. into a wave of something. Everything appears and disappears, or disappears and appears. He's blown away by being one with all of it just as it is. And then he says, he describes his feeling, and he says, profound, peaceful, or really not really peaceful as an adjective, he just says peace, profound, peace, clear light, which sort of infinite energy that means. Doesn't say emptiness, he says clear light. Then he says uncomplicating. In other words, the clear light that he sees is not doing anything because its energy is infinite and sort of everything is already satisfactorily done. Somehow he sees it, the past, present, future, infinite and immediate, macro and micro, you know, clear light, that's all it is. This infinite, self-transcending, self-giving energy, which it also means love in a way, but just as clear light. Then he says uncomplicating or unproliferating, you know, nishprapanja, not because it's not doing anything, it's not creating anything. Anything that's where their suffering is being created by people's ignorance, he sees that. And the energy, the basic energy of the universe is not creating anything, but it's giving to anything whatever it needs. It's able to be drawn from endlessly because it's of infinite energy, infinite abundance. And finally, he says, uncreated, itself uncreated. In other words, no one or no thing or no process created it. It's just the way it's always been. He realizes that. He realizes, in the way, therefore, it's like the ultimate, enlightenment is said to be the ultimate, I always knew that, experience, you know, aha, which is, oh yes, I always knew that. In other words, when you realize it, apparently, you realize you always knew it, but the part of you that knew it, let's say, which is a divisive way of explaining it, but that's why it's inexplicable. But anyway, we do explain anyway. So the part of you that knew it was inaccessible to the part of you you were focused on, because you were held by ignorance apart from your deeper inner knowledge, let's say. I think that makes sense, although ultimately it shows paradox, doesn't it? So, because the one that knows that everything is fine already is the deeper and more powerful and more real one. So why doesn't it automatically overwhelm the other one? You know, why does it take us some effort? Well, maybe ultimately it doesn't when we get there, but it seems to when we feel we need to get there. So it's all very, it will all get break down. And then he said, so this reality is like an elixir of immortality, dudzitavar, amrtavan, you know. It's like a amrtaiva, you know, like a deathlessness. It's like deathlessness, but by deathlessness he meant like an elixir, like a nectar, so sweet, you know, so blissful. So like immortality is this reality that I have discovered, you know, that I have experienced, you know, that I do experience. Trichigornye in Tibetan, you know. And then, he says, right away, whoever I teach it to, they won't get it. So better I don't say anything about it and just stay by myself in the forest, in nature, you know, just hang out quietly all alone in nature. So he immediately says this marvelous thing, like, I know everything. I know the real reality is so blissful and wonderful and great and peaceful, etc., and totally fulfilling, total freedom and bliss. But I can't explain it to another. They won't get it just by hearing my words. It doesn't mean that he's not going to, actually. He ends up, of course, teaching for 46 years in that lifetime. And in a way, he's still teaching because he's still here, everywhere even, more than just a being somewhere in a body in a country somewhere far away in the past and in some other location geographically. He's temporally and geographically, he's here. because his para nirvana, his total nirvana, meant he became everything more overtly by not being located particularly in a particular body exclusively, as it seemed in his Buddha life, you know. So, but him saying that he can't, no one will get it. The word he uses, Gora Mindave, they won't get it in the sense of just from hearing what I say, whatever I teach, they won't get it. Because it cannot be expressed in words, this amazing reality of everything being perfect and yet appearing not to be, to being gripped by ignorance, by misknowing. So that's what we celebrate, someone coming to that. And to him, all time was present, actually. So in a way, his birth is right there also on the same. I think that's why I like the Tibetan tradition, I think coming from India, that the birth was the same day as the enlightenment, as the parinirvana, because in a way, all of those times are all of time, let's say. There is no length of time that's real, you know, that's illusory, the length of time. And by manifesting in a body and withdrawing from that body are all the same, one reality that he becomes an infinite manifestation of clear light, which is really marvelous. So then in the wonderful, I think the most graphic visualization in the exoteric literature of Buddhism is, which is truly astounding, you know, and it swept India and blew away any cobweb, and in a way contributed to what sort of people can perceive, even when Buddhism seems to be gone from India, as it happened 900 years ago when it was kind of suppressed unintentionally or more accidentally suppressed by a bunch of newcomers to India, because it seemed to be so useless, its institutions and everything, and its monastics. And it blew away and contributed to that sense of India's timelessness that everybody notices, you know, where they sort of don't bother with history. They're not so focused on getting from A to B, you know, in a funny way. And there's this deep inner spirituality that India still manifests in spite of having been conquered by others for 1,000 years. Its spirituality almost absorbed them all, one by one. And I think the last absorption now, in a way, of the planet is occurring without us really being aware of it. We think we're fighting over it and we're conquering it, or then different people want to conquer it. But meanwhile, it's already been conquered a long time ago. And inevitably, human beings are going to be forced to enjoy themselves and have a good time, which is all that the Buddha's teaching enables. That's what it's about. It's not about suffering. It's about the freedom he discovered and the bliss of that freedom. So, then in the power, you know, when he was enlightened, then his first, then they say the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Buddha Garland Sutra. Remember, garland is a woven thing of flowers. So here, the woven thing of flowers are all Buddhas. So it's called Buddha Garland Sutra. You know, in the English translation that we have, thanks to the wonderful Thomas Cleary, is called the Flower Ornament Sutra, which is kind of Huayan. That's the Chinese short form, Huayan, which is the Chinese translation of the Indian, you know, Avatamsaka, which means the kind of garland hanging down around the neck of a garland of flowers. So, but it's a Buddha garland, Buddha Avatamsaka, meaning that the garland is, the flowers are made of Buddhas. So it's the vision of the holographic vision of the universe, which is the enlightened vision of the universe, where everything about the universe is whatever is contained like a hologram in every atom of the universe, you know, and it's all clear light, really, you know. And a marvelous jewel net of Indra, all the great metaphors, the similes that they have about it, or in that, they come from that sutra. But according to that sutra, the 49 days that he spent all alone dwelling in the forest without teaching anybody, he was actually teaching everybody. He went into every level of the world, of the cosmos, from the hells to the preta realms, to the animal kingdoms, to all the human kingdoms, to the six desire realm heavens, to the 16 or 17 pure form, pure matter or form realm heavens, and to the all the zillions of deities in the disembodied immaterial or formless heavens. And he gave teachings in all of these places, emanating in different, perhaps in a way, it took 49 days in sort of ordinary history, but it, maybe it was like still going on everywhere or something like that, some sort of eternal thing as he went higher and higher in the heavenly planes, up to the highest plane of material realm, where the Brahma deity dwells, and actually above where the Brahma deity dwells, in the second, that's why I say 16 or 17, sometimes the Akanishta, that highest form realm heaven, is divided in two, that where Brahma dwells, and that's where the Buddha, and then above that where the Buddha verses are, the celestial Buddha lands, like Sukhavati of Amitabha and things like that. And so the Avatamsaka Sutra is just amazing. It all occurs in that, the first two-thirds of it at least occur, by Buddha teaching in all these different heavenly planes, with bodhisattvas following him in all these different cosmic realms. You know, it's really amazing cosmology of it. And it's and one aspect that's amazing, of course, it's different from the modern astrophysics. But one thing that's intriguing and fascinating about it, in spite of the humility of modern Buddhists, that, well, Buddha, in general exoteric terms, he kind of let people feel that, you know, the world was terra-centric and sun and moon go around it, you know, which, of course, relatively speaking, is true. And even sun and moon seem to have the same size to the naked eye. So he catered to that, which was the current view. But nevertheless, the one thing that's really intriguing is that in Flower Ornament Sutra, in Garland Sutra, in Buddha Garland Sutra, there are descriptions of different universes, which are like this kind of flower, that kind of flower, like a hedge, like a flat thing, like a dish. There are all these things which, when we look around at different galaxies, a nebula with the Hubble telescope, we see all these shaped, different shaped universes, or galaxies, we call them. And then, of course, there's beyond a certain distance we can't see because of the nature of light and the nature of our vision, you know. Which doesn't mean that it's not infinite, you know, actually. It just means we don't see any further. And you know, that we don't see a wall, somebody saying this is the end. In fact, it's philosophically incoherent to think that there could be a limit to the limitless universe. And so that coincides, actually. The vision of different galaxies coincide with the different of what they call billion world systems, what the in ancient Mahayana sutras they call the billion world systems. In the desire realm at the human plane level, you know. Because I guess it looks different when the different heavenly planes, you know. But I don't know. Nobody's ever tried to fit them together. So we don't know. So it's hard to translate the things you see. I call them billion world galaxies. But they're just billion world systems, is the literal Sanskrit, you know. Sahasra, tri sahasra. Lokadatta. So Buddha's enlightenment. Now then the Parinirvana Sutra is really wonderful because, just let me say quickly, I don't want to go on too long. In the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, there's two of them, and there's a Pali one, and then there's a Sanskrit one, a Theravada one, and a Mahayana one. And the Theravada one even doesn't have Buddha disappearing into nothingness, so to speak, when he leaves his body. It has him leaving into the Akanishta, into the highest form realm, heaven, the place where matter almost becomes infinite and therefore transcends itself. You know, mass becomes infinite. So speed of light, you could say. you know, where it kind of goes beyond speed of light. And on that event horizon is where he leaves, which actually fits sneakily, although he doesn't mention anything about Buddha lands, you know, Sukhavati, Buddha paradise lands. It fits sneakily with Mahayana cosmology, where that's where the Buddha lands are. So in a way, he goes to Buddha land, or he goes to this land, which Buddha sees as a Buddha land, you could say. So that's in the Pali one. And in various other ways, he hints in the Pali one that he's not leaving. He's making his own body one with everything. So he's there enfolded with everyone. And they can find Dharma everywhere because they will find him everywhere. So he's not abandoning anybody, actually. But he is teaching them impermanence by leaving the continuum of a seemingly separated and exclusive body that he seemed to be occupying. It had been the body of Prince Siddhartha and then was the body of Shakyamuni Buddha. So he abandoned that one. And boy, do they lament it in all versions of the Parinibbana Sutta. Pari, which is always wrongly translated, final Nirvana Sutra, is not final, it's total. Pari means thorough or total. So his total Nirvana, which happens also on this day, is where he becomes one with everything overtly by not exclusively appearing as anything, as him, as the old body that people were thinking of. And we still, when we see an image of Buddha, we think that's Buddha. But even when he was alive, the great sage Vimalakirti, the layman's, stood in front of him and said, "I don't see Buddha when I see your body," meaning you are me also. You are everything. I know that. So I'm not saying that when I see what seems to be an exclusive embodiment of Shakyamuni, which is you, that's not Buddha to me, because I know you are everywhere, as well as manifesting in that form, because that's how people can relate to you at the moment. So. That's stated, right, flatly. And so in Parinibbana, though, but then, you know, when he first starts teaching, after the great teaching of the Garland, Buddha Garland Sutra, he then goes to Varanasi and he teaches people at a different level, starting with the four ascetics who were suffering, you know, with him for 6 years. Starving themselves and torturing themselves in various ways, etc. And he teaches them the Four Noble Truths. He says, this is suffering, and looking at them, that's really quite true. And it has a cause, however, luckily, which we can understand, that cause being craving based on ignorant feeling of separateness from the world. It has a cure, which is nirvana, where you blow away that ignorance by wisdom, and it has, and therefore cease that unsatisfactory craving, suffering of craving. And then there is a way to do that, an education system. You educate yourself in ethics, you educate yourself in your mind, and how to use your mind and intensify the ability of your mind, and you educate yourself with that more empowered mind in wisdom, the understanding of yourself and of the world. In the Eightfold Path and so forth. And that's what he taught them, the Four Noble Truths. However, in various moments in his life, when he teaches the Lotus Sutra, where he shows that life and death are not different, and, you know, to really be alive, you're fully aware of death, and therefore there's no death in the sense of something opposite life as far as you're concerned. It's just you transition moment to moment in a continuum. And in the Lotus Sutra, he teaches, in other places, he teaches in Vimalakirti, he teaches in the Goddess chapter, and especially in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, he teaches the Four Nobler Truths, I would call them, which are the opposite of the Four Noble Truths. He teaches that everything is bliss. He teaches that that's because everything is, the suffering is overwhelmed by the Buddha bliss, which is eternal and beginningless, has always been there. He teaches that nirvana is everyone's natural state. And he teaches that the Eightfold Path is a celebration of that situation. And it's all perfect and pure and everything is utterly great. What I call the nobler truths, which are in a way also, which is also the province of the esoteric teachings that he makes, and which are kept hidden from human beings for 1,000 years and still are really kept a little bit hidden from most people, because they would misunderstand the vision of everything being already perfect as either being unrealistic and totally nonsense because they're so miserable themselves, or as legitimizing their behaving any old which way and being negative and being mean and being greedy and self-centered because everything's perfect, so my self-centeredness is perfect, etc., you know. So they would misunderstand in those two ways unless they already have some level of feeling of the deep blissfulness, the deep well of blissfulness that is all of our reality. So that also we celebrate on this day, in that full moon, in this full moon, the perfection of everything, the nobler truths, which don't really contradict the noble truths, which really the reality is really the third one, which is bliss, you know, freedom, nirvana, being blown away, you know. That's really the reality. So it's there, but it's not emphasized there. He reaches more deeply into our sense of suffering with the first two and the last of the more ones that engage with us in our more illusory level, ignorance-governed and driven, and instinct-driven illusory level. So there's no contradiction. He is the great teacher who engages with us with whatever we need and still does. And we're now engaged as a whole planet on coming to face the lesson of self-restraint, the lesson of nonviolence, and the lesson of taking responsibility for our own individual importance as one of the jewels in the jewel net of Indra, as one of the atoms that contain the whole universe of ourselves, and our own responsibility, therefore, to be of help and be of loving kindness to all beings, which we naturally want to do when we really feel well, when we feel this energy of bliss within ourselves, you know. And all the great teachers of humanity, Jesus, Moses, the female ones, the Shekinah, I'm so thrilled. There's a wonderful book I recently encountered, thanks to the great Anne Lamott, a book called, what's it called? It's called Mercy, Wild Mercy. And in which Shekinah is simply treated as female, not as a ghost. The Shekinah, you know, what becomes in Christianity, in formal Christianity, the Holy Ghost. You know, Shekinah, Sophia, you know, the wisdom goddess, you know, of the West, you know. And, you know, so you have father, mother, and son, rather than father, ghost, and son. You know, the female contribution is recognized there. And I was so thrilled with that, so I have to always mention it. Because, you know, the full moon day is the day when, you know, the sun and moon are reflecting each other in a perfect way. So, and the moon actually, from the Buddhist point of view and esoteric point of view, the moon is the male reflecting at his best possible way and sort of, you know, compassionately muting the ferocious energy of the female, which is the sun, you know, the white and the red, you know, blood and semen, you know, the male and female, rather than that the moon is the female, you know, not at all. She is the power, actually, and the male is kind of muting and balancing of it and celebrating it, complimenting it, worshiping it, actually, by reflecting it in a white light, you know, really cool. So, Mrs. Buddha, we have to remember, you know. So Buddha, the esoteric form of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree is that he was so determined to attain enlightenment there, and he was realizing that he'd been going without everything, you know, to giving everything away in a way, giving his life away. And what he realized he still was doing was breathing. And so he decided he would give up breathing, and he would stake everything, stake his last breath on, insist on the immediacy of the possibility of enlightenment. But then what happened was, in the esoteric thing, he heard finger snaps in front of him, and he looked up, and there was the Shekhinah, there was Sophia, there was the goddess of wisdom, there was the beautiful maiden of and the earthy female woman of wisdom in front of him. And she said, "Oh man, you're going to just choke like that. You're just going to kill yourself. You're going to wreck your regular body, coarse body, in which you can manifest the Buddhahood. So that's bad. Come with me. And then he left the body there in cataleptic trance, went with her in his subtle body to the Akanishta, where the Buddha lands and the Buddha mandalas are. And then he was embraced by all Buddhas and coronated, you could say, as a Buddha, received and initiated, you could say, as a Buddha. And then returned. And that's why when he returned, his body turned all filled out golden and restored health and restored energy. You know, and the initiation is hinted at in the exoteric version by that he received that divine body of yogurt and rice and honey. You know, a divine sort of ice cream was given to him. But, you know, one bowl of honey is not going to restore the health of 6 years of self-torture. So I like the esoteric story as more realistic. But, of course, esoteric for that matter. So the feminine, involvement in every great enlightened teacher's life is more or less visible, and highly visible, really, if we look for it, instead of thinking of all the great teachers of humanity all having been males. That's just a property of the patriarchal traditions we've had for the last few thousand years, slowly unraveling till today. So, Namo Buddham Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Dhammam Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Sangham Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Buddham Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Dhammam Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Sangham Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Buddham Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Dhammam Sharanam Gacchami, Namo Sangham Sharanam Gacchami. So I take refuge in the reality of the truth of Nirvana. I take refuge in the great teacher who taught it, and I take refuge in the community of those who try to live realistically in tune with it and achieve themselves their own enlightenment and freedom and blissfulness and compassionateness. Okay? Doesn't mean when Buddha achieved that himself, he did not become a Buddhist, because there was no such thing. He just began his teaching process. That's all. And that's really what it is even today. So don't worry. You can take refuge in reality confidently and happily in the light of the full moon of the Vaishakha with the comforting feeling that the benevolence, the blissfulness, the suitability, the adequacy of reality is the dominant nature of reality. And any sense of its inadequacy, of its hostility, of its uncomfortableness, of its imperfection, of its miserableness is more illusory, is our suffering, is more unreal and therefore escapable from unreality to reality. Right? All the best. Happy Vaisakha.
Gary Gott, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast, and it's published by Tibet House U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license.
Please be sure to share.
Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.
Tashi Dalek and Happy Sakadawa.